Chapter 27. Dear kind Angelica, as he had told her and all I said. Don't go, George, says Barry, squeezing me by the hand. So I said I was going to sleep at Versailles that night, but if she would give a convoy to Jack Butts, it would be conferring a great obligation on him, with which favor the old lady accordingly complied, saying to him, with great coolness, get up and sit with John in the rumble, Mr. What do you call him? The fact is, the good old soul despises an artist as much as she does a tailor. Jack tripped to his place very meekly, and Emmer Saturday, cried the doctor, and Aunt Forget Thursday, exclaimed the divine, bachelor's party, you know. And so the cavalcade drove thundering down the gloomy old Avenue de Paris. The Frenchman, I forgot to say, had gone away exceedingly ill long before, and the reminiscences of Thursday and Adderday evoked by Dobus and Way were, to tell the truth, parts of our conspiracy. For in the heat of Barry's courage, we had made him promise to dine with us all round Dengarkin, with all except Captain Goff, who recollected that he was engaged every day for the next 3 weeks, as indeed he is, to a 30 souse ordinary which the gallant officer frequents, when not invited elsewhere. Cutler and I then were the last on the field, and though we were for moving away, Barry, whose vigor had, if possible, been excited by the bustle and colloquy in the night air, insisted upon dragging us back again, and actually proposed a grill for supper. We found in the salle manger a strong smell of an extinguished lamp, and Mrs. Barry was snuffing out the candles on the sideboard. "Hello, my dear," shouts Barry. "AC, if you please, we've not done yet." "Not done yet, Mr. Barry," groans the lady, in a hollow sepulchral tone. "No, Mrs. B, not done yet. We are going to have some supper, ain't we, George?" "I think it's quite time to go home," said Mr. Fitzboodle, who, to say the truth, began to tremble himself. "I think it is, sir. You are quite right, sir. You will pardon me, gentlemen. I have a bad headache, and will retire." "Good night, my dear," said that audacious Barry. "Natole, tell the cook to broil a fowl, and bring some wine." If the loving couple had been alone, or if Cutler had not been an attaché to the embassy, before whom she was afraid of making herself ridiculous, I am confident that Mrs. Barry would have fainted away on the spot, and that all Barry's courage would have tumbled down lifeless by the side of her. So she only gave a martyrized look, and left the room, and while we partook of the very unnecessary repast, was good enough to sing some hymn tunes to an exceedingly slow movement in the next room, intimating that she was awake, and that, though suffering, she found her consolations in religion. These melodies did not in the least add to our friend's courage. The deviled fowl had, somehow, no devil in it. The champagne in the glasses looked exceedingly flat and blue. The fact is, that Cutler and I were now both in a state of dire consternation, and soon made a move for our hats, and lighting each a cigar in the hall, made across the little green, where the cupids and nymphs were listening to the dribbling fountain in the dark. "I'm hanged if I don't have a cigar too," says Barry, rushing after us, and accordingly putting in his pocket a key about the size of a shovel, which hung by the little handle of the outer grill, forth he sallied, and joined us in our fumigation. He stayed with us a couple of hours, and returned homewards in perfect good spirits, having given me his word of honor he would dine with us the next day. He put his immense key into the grill, and unlocked it, but the gate would not open. It was bolted within. He began to make a furious jangling and ringing at the bell, and in oaths, both French and English, called upon the recalcitrant Anatole. After much tolling of the bell, a light came cutting across the crevices of the inner door. It was thrown open, and a figure appeared with a lamp, a tall slim figure of a woman, clothed in white from head to foot. It was Mrs. Barry, and when Cutler and I saw her, we both ran away as fast as our legs could carry us. Barry, at this, shrieked with a wild laughter. Ever tomorrow, old boys, shouted he, it's o'clock. And we were a quarter of a mile off when the gate closed, and the little mansion of the Avenue de Paris was once more quiet and dark. The next afternoon, as we were playing at billiards, Cutler saw Mrs. Berry drive by in her carriage, and as soon as rather a long rubber was over, I thought I would go and look for our poor friend, and so went down to the pavilion. Every door was open, as the wont is in France, and I walked in unannounced, and saw this. He was playing a duet with her on the flute. As he had been out but for half an hour, after not speaking all the morning, and having seen Cutler at the billiard room window, and suspecting we might take advantage of her absence, as he had suddenly returned home again, and had flung herself, weeping, into her Frank's arms, and said she could not bear to leave him in anger. And so, after sitting for a little while sobbing on his knee, as he had forgotten, and forgiven everything. The dear angel. I met poor Frank in Bond Street only yesterday. But he crossed over to the other side of the way. He had on galoshes, and is grown very fat and pale. He has shaved off his mustaches, and, instead, wears a respirator. He has taken his name off all his clubs, and lives very grimly in Baker Street. Well, ladies, no doubt you say he is right. And what are the odds, so long as you are happy? Dennis Haggarty's wife. There was an odious Irishwoman who with her daughter used to frequent the Oil Hotel at Leamington some years ago, and who went by the name of Mrs. Major Gam. Gam had been a distinguished officer in His Majesty's service, whom nothing but death and his own amiable wife could overcome. The widow mourned her husband in the most becoming bombazine she could muster, and had at least half an inch of lampblack round the immense visiting tickets which she left at the houses of the nobility and gentry her friends. Some of us, I am sorry to say, used to call her Mrs. Major Gammon, for if the worthy widow had a propensity, it was to talk largely of herself, and family of her own family, for she held her husband's very cheap, and of the wonders of her paternal mansion, Molloyville, County of Mayo. She was of the Molloys of that county, and though I never heard of the family before, I have little doubt, from what Mrs. Major Gam stated, that they were the most ancient and illustrious family of that part of Ireland. I remember there came down to see his aunt a young fellow with huge red whiskers and tight nankeens, a green coat, and an awful breastpin, who, after 2 days' stay at the spa, proposed marriage to Miss S., or, in default, a duel with her father, and who drove a flash curricle with a bay and a gray, and who was presented with much pride by Mrs. Gam as Castlery Molloy of Molloyville. We all agreed that he was the most insufferable snob of the whole season, and were delighted when a bailiff came down in search of him. Well, this is all I know personally of the Molloyville family, but at the house, if you met the widow Gam, and talked on any subject in life, you were sure to hear of it. If you asked her to have peas at dinner, she would say, "Oh, sir, after the peas at Molloyville, I really don't care for any others, do I, dearest Jemima?" We always had a dish in the month of June, when my father gave his head gardener a guinea we had three at Molloyville, and sent him with his compliments, and a quart of peas to our neighbor, dear Lord Morofit. What a sweet place Morofit Park is! Isn't it, Jemima? If a carriage passed by the window, Mrs. Major Gammon would be sure to tell you that there were three carriages at Molloyville, the barouche, the chariot, and the covered sire. In the same manner she would favor you with the number and names of the footmen of the establishment. And on a visit to Warwick Castle, for this bustling woman made one in every party of pleasure that was formed from the hotel, she gave us to understand that the great walk by the river was altogether inferior to the principal avenue of Molloyville Park. I should not have been able to tell so much about Mrs. Gam and her daughter, but that, between ourselves, I was particularly sweet upon a young lady at the time, whose papa lived at the Oil, and was under the care of Dr. Jeffson. The Jemima appealed to by Mrs. Gam in the above sentence was, of course, her daughter, apostrophized by her mother, Jemima, my soul's darling, or Jemima, my blessed child, or comma Jemima, my own love. The sacrifices that Mrs. Gam had made for that daughter were, she said, astonishing. The money he had spent in masters upon her, the illnesses through which he had nursed her, the ineffable love the mother bore her, were only known to heaven, Mrs. Gam said. They used to come into the room with their arms round each other's waists. At dinner between the courses the mother would sit with one hand locked in her daughter's, and if only two or three young men were present at the time, would be pretty sure to kiss her Jemima more than once during the time, whilst the bohea was poured out. As for Miss Gam, if she was not handsome, candor forbids me to say she was ugly. She was neither one nor t'other. She was a person who wore ringlets, and a band round her forehead. She knew four songs, which became rather tedious at the end of a couple of months' acquaintance. As he had excessively bare shoulders, she inclined to wear numbers of cheap ornaments, rings, brooches, ferronieres, smelling bottles, and was always, we thought, very smartly dressed. Though old Mrs. Lynx hinted that her gowns and her mother's were turned over and over again, and that her eyes were almost put out by darning stockings. These eyes Miss Gam had very large, though rather red and weak, and used to roll them about at every eligible unmarried man in the place. But though the widow subscribed to all the balls, though she hired a fly to go to the meet of the hounds, though she was constant at church, and Jemima sang louder than any person there except the clerk, and though, probably, any person who made her a happy husband would be invited down to enjoy the three footmen, gardeners, and carriages at Molloyville, yet no English gentleman was found sufficiently audacious to propose. Old Lynx used to say that the pair had been at Tunbridge, Harrogate, Brighton, Ramsgate, Cheltenham, for this 8 years past, where they had met, it seemed, with no better fortune. Indeed, the widow looked rather high for her blessed child. And as she looked with the contempt which no small number of Irish people feel upon all persons who get their bread by labor or commerce, and as she was a person whose energetic manners, costume, and brogue were not much to the taste of quiet English country gentlemen, Jemima's sweet, spotless flower still remained on her hands, a thought withered, perhaps, unseedy. Now, at this time, the 120th Regiment was quartered at Wheaton Barracks, and with the corps was a certain Assistant Surgeon Haggarty, a large, lean, tough, raw-boned man, with big hands, knock-knees, and carroty whiskers, and, withal, as honest a creature as ever handled a lancet. Haggarty, as his name imports, was of the very same nation as Mrs. Gam, and, what is more, the honest fellow had some of the peculiarities which belonged to the widow, and bragged about his family almost as much as she did. I do not know of what particular part of Ireland they were kings, but monarchs they must have been, as have been the ancestors of so many thousand Hibernian families. But they had been men of no small consideration in Dublin, where my father, Haggarty said, is as well known as King William's statue, and where he rowels his carriage to, apostrophe let me tell ye. Hence, Haggarty was called by the wax owl the carriage, and several of them made inquiries of Mrs. Gam regarding him. Mrs. Gam, when you used to go up from Molloyville to the Lord Lieutenant's balls, and at your townhouse in Fitzwilliam Square, used you to meet the famous Dr. Haggarty in society? Is it Surgeon Haggarty of Gloucester Street ye mean? The Black Papist. Do you suppose that the Molloys would sit down to table with a creature of that sort? Why, isn't he the most famous physician in Dublin, and doesn't he rowel his carriage there? The horrid wretch. He keeps a shop, I tell ye, and sends his sons out with the medicine. He's got four of them off into the army, Ulick, and Phil, and Terence and Denny, and now it's Charles that takes out the physic. But how should I know about these odious creatures? Their mother was a Burke, of Burkestown, County Cavan, and brought Surgeon Haggarty £2,000. She was a Protestant, and I am surprised how she could have taken up with a horrid odious popish apothecary. From the extent of the widow's information, I am led to suppose that the inhabitants of Dublin are not less anxious about their neighbors than are the natives of English cities, and I think it is very probable that Mrs. Gam's account of the young Haggardys who carried out the medicine is perfectly correct, for a lad in the 120th made a caricature of Haggardy coming out of a chemist's shop with an oilcloth basket under his arm, which set the worthy surgeon in such a fury that there would have been a duel between him and the ensign, could the fiery doctor have had his way. Now, Dionysius Haggardy was of an exceedingly inflammable temperament, and it chanced that of all the invalids, the visitors, the young squires of Warwickshire, the young manufacturers from Birmingham, the young officers from the barracks, it chanced, unluckily for Miss Gam and himself, that he was the only individual who was in the least smitten by her personal charms. He was very tender and modest about his love, however, for it must be owned that he respected Mrs. Gam hugely, and fully admitted, like a good simple fellow as he was, the superiority of that lady's birth and breeding to his own. How could he hope that he, a humble assistant surgeon, with £1,000 his Aunt Kitty left him for all his fortune, how could he hope that one of the race of Molloyville would ever condescend to marry him? Inflamed, however, by love, and inspired by wine, one day at a picnic at Kenilworth, Haggardy, whose love and raptures were the talk of the whole regiment, was induced by his waggish comrades to make a proposal in form. "Are you aware, Mr. Haggardy, that you are speaking to a Molloy?" was all the reply majestic Mrs. Gam made when, according to the usual formula, the fluttering Jemima referred her suitor to Emma. She left him with a look which was meant to crush the poor fellow to earth. She gathered up her cloak and bonnet, and precipitately called for her fly. She took care to tell every single soul in Leamington that the son of the odious papist apothecary had had the audacity to propose for her daughter. Indeed, a proposal, coming from whatever quarter it may, does no harm, and left Haggardy in a state of extreme depression and despair. His downheartedness, indeed, surprised most of his acquaintances in and out of the regiment, for the young lady was no beauty, and a doubtful fortune, and Dennis was a man outwardly of an unromantic turn, who seemed to have a great deal more liking for beefsteak and whiskey punch than for women, however fascinating. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.